September 5th, 2018, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean,
Amy.
Damon Kiso. This week on our program, the New Yorker Festival drops Steve Bannon from its lineup after a number of celebrities said they wouldn't participate if he was there. A court in Myanmar sentenced two Reuters journalists to 7 years in prison for reporting the truth about civil rights violations in that country. And we'll take a look at some of the creative reporting projects from across the country that are having impact on their communities. And there's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But let's start with the finger pointing between a former NBC producer and network chair Andy Lax over whether NBC actively tried to quash the Harvey Weinstein story last summer and fall. What it really seems to be coming down here is a claim that either side doesn't just seem to agree on at what point this story became bulletproof, at what point it was really ready for air and for publication.
Right, and this new producer, the producer who just left NBC News and who worked with Ronan Farrow on the piece, basically said, we had somebody who was willing to go on camera and to be identified accusing Harvey Weinstein. NBC claimed that never did Farrow ever get anyone who was willing to be identified as the source, and that was a go, no-go situation for the story. There's a lot of other accusations that are part of this latest business, but that's the central question. Did NBC kill the story because it didn't meet their standards, or did NBC kill the story because of pressure from Weinstein or others?
I mean, if you back up, the Comcast that owns NBC at this point, it's a $14 billion company. If they were close to having enough to push this story live, they could have given them another month or 2 months, whatever it took. So it's tough to believe just on face value NBC's story on this.
Well, especially considering there has been a woman, one of the accusers, who said she was willing to go on camera. That interview had not yet happened, but that she was willing to go ahead and do that.
Yes, I recall the situation. She had given an interview where she had been cast in shadow and not identified, and she had said she was willing to come in and be identified as part of the story. But there's an awful lot of question as to whether or not there was some pressure, because Farrow went from allegedly not having any sources willing to be identified to 2 weeks later, when the story was published in the New Yorker, to having, what, six or seven women who had been identified as accusing Weinstein. So that seems like an awful short period of time to get those many sources to go ahead if they wouldn't do it with NBC.
Well, and most of them being household names well, too. So it isn't as though it was a question about whether or not being shot in silhouette for that interview would have protected any kind of anonymity. They were already, in a lot of these cases, public figures.
And keep in mind, the original thread that they took to start this coverage was a public tweet, which hadn't been connected just directly, but it certainly ended up being related. So these are public, sort of public, but not widely shared. Facts.
Don't you think, too, I mean, this is obvious, I suppose, as much as we've talked about these various stories over the past year or so, but NBC might have gotten the benefit of the doubt from some reporters in some quarters, except for the track record that they had developed over the past year with the Me Too movement, I mean, in terms of how they did or did not handle the Matt Lauer situation, how they did or did not handle the allegations against Tom Brokaw, et cetera. I mean, there were lots of these instances where NBC seemed to be coming down on the wrong side of aggressive reporting.
And some of that even as recently, too, one could argue as recently as today, with the, quite literally, the Today Show, with the promotion of Craig Melvin very quietly adding another man to the cast of the Today Show, where Matt Lauer had given up that, or been removed from that position, adding another man there as the new news reader, but doing it very quietly so as not to draw any attention.
There's a lot of, you know, speculation as to whether Andy Lack, the chairman of NBC News, might not be long for his position there because of what's going on, even though he's done a good job of protecting the bottom line of the network. You know, we're going to see what's going to happen, but I have to imagine that that Ronan Farrow is going to have more to say when his book about all of this comes out in a few months.
I mean, it comes down to either they let the story get away, which is a mistake journalistically, or they squashed it, which is even more of a mistake. there's just no good answer for them on this.
Okay. Well, it's been a few weeks, maybe months, since we've mentioned FCC Chairman Ajit Pai's name on this program, but he's making news again, this time with a blog post he published on the platform Medium yesterday. In it, he detailed the things he's looking to hear from the leaders of Facebook, Twitter, and Google as they appear before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. Chief among them, transparency. He wants them to be frank with the senators and with the American people about how they make their decisions about what we see and what we don't online. He wants to know who makes those decisions, and maybe if they're not prepared to be transparent, that it's time for the government to regulate the algorithms that serve up that content. His sentiment seems pretty reasonable on the face of it, but at the same time, also knowing about how he got his appointment, his conservative leanings, and what we talked about a lot on this show last week about the president's reaction to not liking Google rankings, how much of it's political?
Well, lots of it is political. I mean, first of all the examples that he points to in his blog piece are the examples of conservative voices allegedly being stifled by social media. That doesn't mean that the notion that these companies should be more transparent isn't a valid one. It's true, we ought to know, news organizations have wanted to know for a long time how the algorithms really work and how they get tweaked. Same is true about privacy questions. What kind of data are they collecting, whether or not their terms of service claim they're collecting it? So there are legitimate issues in his post. It's just unfortunate that it comes at a time when his motives are being questioned. So I don't know how much people will pay attention to it unless they're on the president's and his side.
I think you're right. We definitely have an interest in understanding how these platforms work more clearly and getting that transparency. You're not going to get transparency for an algorithm. No one can really understand how those systems work at this point. And at this point, no matter what they do, the president and others in the administration tweeting and making allegations against these platforms, just you can't separate it from the politics, from the truth of the reality at this point.
Well, and the FCC chairman has this sort of interesting and ironic position on suggesting that the government might need to get involved when he's done just the opposite with the FCC in deregulating internet service providers as far as privacy information and that sort of stuff. So that's just kind of interesting. But it does seem to me that the basic question of do we want the government to decide whether or not these companies are doing the right thing and dictating what policies they should have, I wouldn't go there.
So, I mean, just today we have the social media platforms up in front of Congress. We have Trump tweeting about the unfairness of Google and others. And we have the Department of Justice setting up meetings with the state attorneys general to look into the unfairness of some of these things. So whether or not the FCC ends up taking any action, there's multiple fronts of movement going on, which may turn out to be nothing, but.
So many a times we've talked about how some of these platforms, and specifically, you know, Mark Zuckerberg in particular, saying, I'm not a content provider. This isn't journalism. I'm not a journalist. Do you see perhaps an opportunity where they may try to open that door and hide behind some of that that publisher and First Amendment things that they kind of shied away from in the past? That's not who we are. That's not what we do. But now when they may be facing regulation that perhaps they don't want to face, that all of a sudden our side of the fence may have some pretty green grass?
You're already seeing that. Every action, if you're cynical about it, every action they've taken in the past 6 months has been to avoid the regulation that's probably coming their way in one form or another.
And it's interesting to me that we'd pay a lot more attention to this story today in the media if it wasn't up against the Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings. Mm-hmm. Those are just too juicy, too much red political meat. So the media are going to spend most of their time talking about that, less of their time talking about these social media companies. Even though what could happen is more in doubt with the social media companies than what's going to happen to Kavanaugh. Unless, you know, the world comes to an end, he is probably going to be our next Supreme Court justice.
Where you're going to see the action come from is from the regulators in Europe. They're going to take the first action, and the United States will end up taking some sort of smaller or lesser action, but they'll end up self-governing themselves based on the regulations overseas.
And we've seen that happen already as it relates to privacy in a couple of other situations. Well, Monday, there was a blow for the free press, a dark moment, as a judge in Myanmar sentenced two Reuters journalists to 7 years in prison, convicting them of breaching a law on state secrets when they handled documents relating to the killing of Rohingya Muslims. Here is Reuters Asia bureau chief.
Anyone who's followed this trial will understand that by any impartial standard, by any fair standard, this trial established the innocence of Wallone and Chosa.
So everything about this investigation, everything about this trial, it all led to a pretty clear picture that these two journalists were set up. They were framed.
Yeah. They were framed because they were convicted of violating the Official Secrets Act by obtaining government documents. And the way they obtained the government documents, a military source sort of insisted that they come and have a meal because he wanted to share something, hands them some rolled up pieces of paper. They walk out of the restaurant and they're immediately arrested before they even get a chance to read them, let alone to know that there's some sort of government secrets that they don't have a right to have access to. That was all pretty much confirmed in open court, and yet the judge still convicted them. So it was clearly a setup.
It's obviously entrapment. And the question is, at this point, how long before we actually get action to get them out of jail? You can't assume, and we've seen in past cases, they'll actually serve a 7-year sentence. But what is it going to take in terms of public outcry, government pressure to move that needle and get them out?
Well, and there has been that public outcry already. There are advocacy groups around the globe that are stepping up. There are governments, Nikki Haley is our ambassador to the UN, saying right then and there that calling for their immediate release and saying that in a free country, it's the duty and a duty of a responsible press to keep people informed and hold leaders accountable. Also ironic that Nikki Haley is saying that at the same time we're talking about some of the other things we're talking about.
Yeah, it's also ironic that Aung San Suu Kyi, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, who was under house arrest in her own country for 15 years for speaking out against the government, her government, at least ostensibly, is the one that prosecuted these two journalists. So they still have a chance to appeal, I think, in two different levels of their court system. So there's still an opportunity to put pressure. There's still an opportunity for negotiations. Mm-hmm. We saw how some of the sentences were reduced in Egypt when journalists were jailed there. So it's not over yet, but it's still disturbing.
Part of that statement that I had referred to earlier from Nikki Haley, she called this another stain on the Burmese government. Mm-hmm. Damon, this is something that you had brought up to me the other day. It's something I've thought about, too. Our own government is referring to this country where this happened is Burma. Still.
Yep.
But what we see in all of the coverage mm-hmm. and in the guidance from the Associated Press is to refer to the country as Myanmar.
Yep. Yeah. So it's been since 1989 when the military junta took over after a popular uprising that they changed it basically overnight from Burma to Myanmar. Now, both of those are traditional names that have been used in the country, but that official name change was done without any input. So the current Prime Minister, Suu Kyi, at the time, who was imprisoned shortly after that, favors Burma. She has a book called Letters from Burma, which were letters from when she was in jail. And since she's taken over as basically the prime minister role, she's softened her stance on that a little bit to try to probably be, you know, diplomatic within the country. But it's just curious that the United States and the UK especially still strongly refer to as Burma. When Obama and Clinton visited there several years ago, they tread that line very carefully. But the AP style is Myanmar. And it just seems like if that's not the choice of the people in the country, maybe we should reconsider that choice ourselves.
Yeah, and I saw that you posted a piece on our links blog from NPR where their standards editor was talking about why they've begun eliminating this sort of parenthetical yes. reference to, you know, formerly known as Burma or whatever,
yeah.
because everybody kind of gets that now. I'm not sure that's necessarily true, and I'm kind of a little bit divided. A country should be able to call itself mm-hmm. what it wants to call itself, but this isn't the citizens of the country. This is the military junta that decided that. I mean, you know, we could the people in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
I was thinking
or whatever,
exactly. We call it North Korea. We don't call it the DPRK.
Or Taiwan would like to call itself Taiwan, but can't in the United Nations or at the Olympics because China won't let them and they put enough mm-hmm. political pressure. So it's not as simple as saying, you know, let them call themselves what they want to call mm-hmm. themselves. But journalists do need to be consistent.
Yeah. And I think we could take a stand on this, at least keeping the parenthetical, also known as Burma, that NPR had done for quite a while in their coverage.
Okay. That, again, valid points, and I'm glad that you brought them up. One of the biggest alternative revenue streams for news organizations, something that has become very trendy, having events. So, for instance, last spring, Vox Magazine, it had its farm-to-table event. The Missourian is planning its second annual Progress Awards. These are ways to bring the community together to drive conversation and sometimes for local media organizations to sell tickets. The New Yorker is holding its festival on October 6th and 7th, and it has some pretty big names on the bill, Jim Carrey, Jimmy Fallon, but it's making news for who isn't on there anymore. Steve Bannon. The idea was to have David Remnick interview Bannon in what was going to be a no-holds-barred, very upfront and very frank interview. But some of those other Hollywood names I was talking about, they said if he's going to be there, we're not. Mm-hmm. And the New Yorker succumbed to that pressure and disinvited him.
Yeah, that, which is a win for Bannon in either case. Once that invitation was made, it was pretty clear from past history he was going to be disinvited once that was public. So, I mean, there's a study out in June of this year, the Oxygen of Amplification, Whitney Phillips, an academic study, saying basically giving people a bad faith, a platform from which to promote their ideas in bad faith, doesn't help free speech. It's not a debate of ideas. It's now just giving oxygen to the bad ideas.
I think that's a legitimate argument, and you heard it coming from several people. Chelsea Clinton was tweeting that we were normalizing bigotry if we allowed Steve Bannon to have a platform. On the other hand, I can make a journalistic argument that, you know, we need to expose this person's ideas. We need to aggressively question them. After it was announced that the New Yorker had caved in to like five comedians who said, we won't show up if he shows up, The Economist, which is also hosting an event actually earlier, sometime later this month, yeah. I think, their editor-in-chief said, no, we're going to continue to have him show up and we're going to ask him questions because his sort of nativist nationalism, white supremacy, whatever label you want to use, is influencing politics in a lot of countries. And he is directly involved in advising countries on this sort of policy. So he is a legitimate source. However, I can see the argument that we don't want to just put somebody on there if they're not actually making news, but we're just normalizing their speech.
I think there's a big difference between treating someone as a source in a news story and putting them in the context and putting up on stage with their name on the marquee out front. This was Steve Bannon headlining the New Yorker event. That's how it was tweeted. That's how it was referred to. That's not a good look for a journalism organization.
But wouldn't it have been better if they'd made that decision up front instead of waiting for Judd Apatow and John Mulaney and Jim Carrey and Patton Oswalt to say, we're not going to show up.
Right. Like what this decision was actually made based on pressure from the guy from Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure who looks worse in that scenario.
Well, but just throwing the words dumb and dumber into the context of this conversation, go ahead, what were you going to say?
But that's one of that's really foreseeable that this decision was going to play out this way. It's happened before. Why do we keep sort of making the same mistake in the media, I think, is a question.
Okay. Well, one of the things that we don't get to do enough of on this program, really take a look at some of the great journalism that's being done around the country and to look for reporting and projects that stand out. So there are a couple that I noticed this week that I want to spend some time talking about. The first is a project that at a time when journalists have been lamenting not paying enough attention to rural areas as well as we should have been, is focusing on the youth of Appalachia. 100 Days in Appalachia is really taking a look. This is a project that started a couple years ago but is focusing very heavily right now and between now and the election itself on the opinions of high school students and how their political opinions are forming right now.
So I would say a couple of things. One, I mean, just kudos to all the people who've organized this. And yes, we compete with them for students, but let's give a shout out to West Virginia University and their College of Media. They've organized this whole thing.
Well, this is in their backyard.
It is in their backyard.
It's appropriate that we give that shout out. And yeah. More power to them.
And also to the folks who are helping fund it. I mean, the Knight Foundation, which also funds Damon's position here at the university, is putting up some money to make that happen. That's good. I agree completely with the notion of trying to focus on what young people, especially high school students, have to say about the issues that matter to them. I also think it would be really helpful to have those students' voices appear in these media stories, and perhaps they will before we get to the end of it. I mean, writing the stories. We actually have a project here that we're working on at RJI, where we have a fellow who is doing just that, going out to high schools around mid-Missouri and recruiting the students there to not only tell us what they're interested in journalism, but to create their own content to tell their own stories. Mm-hmm. And I think projects like this one and the one in West Virginia and Appalachia are really important now as we're trying to understand voters and citizens that we don't really understand very well.
One of the interesting things, apart from the content that's coming out of this, is the technique they're using. They're using cell phones and text messaging, mm-hmm. a very basic technology we don't pay a lot of attention to.
And but it's the native to that generation.
Absolutely.
They'd rather communicate with you via text message than ever have a conversation with you.
And it's asking non-binary questions about politics. So they're not just going yes or no, conservative or liberal. They're really trying to understand sort of the gray areas in there and understand, you know, what their perception is if it's different than the current generation.
And one of the other things that really struck me about this project as I was learning about it yesterday when I just stumbled upon it, back to the high school student idea, using that subset of the population in a very red state that had perhaps not been listened to heavily prior to that 2016 election, they're not likely to be voting in the midterms where we're getting this information. But if they're in high school and they're juniors and seniors now, they're most definitely going to be voting in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other thing I like about the project, from what I could see of the stories that have been published so far, is I think they can make a legitimate claim to being nonpartisan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think the stories come across as left-right. They're just focusing on the people in those communities in Appalachia from a variety of different points of view.
Yeah. So another piece that is worth taking a look at, and this is a year-long series that ran in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and it told the story of the trauma that inner-city kids experience through the eyes of a youth football team.
When I grew up, I wanted to be a teacher.
A football player.
A scientist.
A canine unit.
Football player. And if I can't be there, I'll be an NBA player.
I started watching that when one of the football players that got killed right after the storm. Then the next thing you know, another athlete got killed. I'm like, whoa, hold up. So all of a sudden, I said, hold on, let me start writing this down. So I start putting his name, Joseph Single first, and the rest of them, and so on, so on, so on. Since 2003 to now, I have lost 28 football players.
Every time I come outside, it's either somebody getting killed, somebody getting shot.
I actually lost a brother in 1995.
People selling drugs. That's what I seen night in and night out, being a kid.
And now that I got to 28, it started to open people's minds up.
So that video comes as part of a micro documentary. You can watch the entire thing. It's about 15 minutes long. It's on our links blog. And it was designed to accompany this year-long series that have some really deep looks at trauma, at food insecurity, at homelessness, at street violence. And looking at it after this year of reporting, it's had some tremendous impact on the city of New Orleans.
It's hard to do this. I mean, let's give credit where credit is due. Local news organizations, mm-hmm. especially newspapers, their finances are in bad, bad shape. And to commit the kind of resources to do this kind of in-depth storytelling, and especially to commit resources to things they may not have been particularly adept at in the past, with video documentaries mm-hmm. or whatever, that takes a real commitment. And I hope that we're going to prove that it's exactly that kind of commitment that's necessary to develop, to reestablish connections in the community. They're going to keep community journalism alive. But you know, when you're right in the middle of it and you're thinking, how am I going to make the next, you know, payroll or whatever, that's a hard decision to make.
I mean, to even reinforce that more, this is from the Times-Picayune is an advanced newspaper, that group. This paper won Pulitzer Prizes for Katrina coverage. Mm-hmm. Several years later, they had cutbacks. They cut back the number of days they were publishing. They're now back to 7 days a week. They've not had an easy go of it, as many haven't. And to be able to dedicate a year to this and create that kind of content, it's just amazing work.
And it's not just that it's like this stunning content and this amazing storytelling. There are laws being changed in that city. There is money being rededicated to the schools, to civil programs. it's having direct impact mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. affecting the quality of life mm-hmm. for children in that community.
And they're not the only traditional newspaper that's ventured into mm-hmm. documentary mm-hmm. production. You're seeing a lot more community yep. newspapers doing this. And I think that's a format that I think there's a lot of a future for that kind of work.
Okay. So, but my favorite part is the end of the year, the paper hosted the banquet mm-hmm. for the student, for the football team, which is just a nice touch.
Okay. Well, sometimes on this program, we also get a chance to talk about advertising in addition to journalism and news. And sometimes it's the advertising that makes news, like the release of Nike's newest Just Do It ad marking the 30th anniversary of the campaign. On it, a close-up black and white photo of Colin Kaepernick with the words, "Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything," across the bridge of his nose. You'll remember that Kaepernick is the former NFL quarterback who led that national anthem protest movement by taking a knee, and many players followed suit from there. He has since been out of a job for more than a year, and this is a pretty big, bold move for Nike, one that is being said to perhaps reconnect them with Generation Z and with the young folks who are following after them.
Mm-hmm. And not to be cynical about their support of Kaepernick, who is seen as a leader of a social movement at this point, I don't believe Nike's doing this for social good. If that's a benefit, maybe. But they're after that audience who's not NFL fans. They're younger. They're more urban in terms of the urban-rural divide. And they like him, or they like his image. And Nike thinks they're going to sell more shoes.
They are taking a risk, and obviously they're willing to. I can't believe they just jumped into this blindly. But you're seeing the pushback already on social media. A lot of conservative folks who are saying they're burning their Nikes, you know, and posting the video on Twitter. You know, you've got people saying, "Oh, well, why don't you focus on Pat Tillman, the NFL player who actually quit his team, the Arizona Cardinals, mm-hmm. joined the mm-hmm. military and was shot and killed in Afghanistan?" Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting that kind of clear pushback, so they must think there's enough upside to try this. I'll say with Colin Kaepernick, you know, things are looking a lot better for him now than they have been in the recent past. Not only did he get this contract, and they're going to sell apparel, and if it mm-hmm. goes well enough, he could be getting the kinds of fees that other top athletes are getting, but he also just won a case against the NFL. His arbitrator says that, yes, his case against the NFL, that they were colluding to keep him out of the league, could go forward. So good times for him.
Yep.
Well, and what's also interesting about this campaign is Colin Kaepernick is the person that everybody's talking about this week. But, you know, last week, very subtly, Nike was also supporting Serena Williams mm-hmm. when she was told she couldn't wear the cat suit that she wanted to wear to play in the tournament last week. Well, that music means we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. You can leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about in our next program, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. Ellie Fitzgerald is our social media producer. I'm Amy Simons, bidding you farewell for a few weeks. We're going to be off next week for the annual Online News Association conference, and Mike will be in this seat filling in for me on the 19th. Be sure to join him and Ernest Perry when they're back with you for our next edition of Views of the News.